The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I thought of talking about happiness today. And I feel a little bit shy talking about happiness because not everyone's happy. And if you talk about happiness, it might seem like you're supposed to be happy, and if you're not happy, then somehow you're doing it wrong or not quite right. And so it's easier to talk about suffering, because if you're not suffering, then most people won't think, well, I'm supposed to be suffering. I'm not doing it right because I'm not suffering enough. But to talk the other direction about happiness is a little bit more tricky, and I feel I do it with a lot of respect for the challenges people have and difficulties people have. But there's no way around it that in the teachings of the Buddha, happiness is a very important component part of the overall path of practice. That when he described a path, a journey that people took through Buddhism, that's a journey that the different stages of it involve degrees of happiness and joy, delight and gladness. And that this is kind of a part of the deal, well before becoming enlightened. And so it's part of the whole process, and it's good to have some familiarity with it or some understanding of it and how it works. And it's been my experience in my own life that I have a capacity, which I practice regularly, of not allowing myself to be as happy as I could be. Because I'm busy doing things. I'm too busy to be happy. You know, I'm involved in things or concerned about things. But, you know, some degree of happiness, well-being, is often not very far away. And the question is, for me sometimes, is should I avail myself more of the sense of well-being or happiness or joy that's available or not? Or should I continue kind of doing whatever I'm doing, the emails I'm doing? So the question is, one of the questions behind this talk for all of us is to how much choice do we have in the degree to which we feel some happiness, some well-being, some joy, some delight, some appreciation, some contentment? To what degree is there choice? And what would that choice look like? Where is there choice? And what goes into the choices we make around being happy or not being happy, allowing it to be there or not allowing it to be there? So I'd like to tell a variation of a story that is told often and often enough. there was a man who was not happy, and he tried for many years to become happy and did all the kind of standard things people do, tried to be wealthy, tried to have status, tried to have a lot of goods, tried to have a wonderful relationship, many things that people pursue in order to be happy, and none of those helped him. And then he heard about meditation. He tried that, and it didn't help much either. And so he went to a wise woman, wise teacher, and said, "What should I do? You know, I've done all these different things, and I've done all things that, you know, I've learned that you know are supposed to lead to happiness, and nothing has helped me. And what can I do?" The teacher, she said to him, "You have to go find a person who's genuinely happy, the most genuinely happy person, and ask the person for the person's shirt and bring it back here." So he went off and asked people, "You know anyone who's genuinely happy, totally happy?" And some people scratched their heads and no idea, and some people said, "Well, maybe there." And person would ask, "Are you really genuinely happy?" And they'd say, no, I'm, you know, fairly good, but no, I'm not genuinely fully happy. And it took years of asking and checking in people out, and sometimes they thought, but this person looked pretty happy, but then spend a couple of days with a person, and lo and behold, and you know, it wasn't genuinely fully, whatever that means. But then after many years of search, they heard, oh, they're over there, back behind the mountain in the back country, and, you know, in the next country over or something. There's this person who's rumored to be genuinely happy, really happy. So the person got all excited, and as the person got closer and closer, yet people say, oh yeah, there's that person there. We think that person's genuinely happy. Got closer, and yes, that person, like, and got close enough, and people would smile when this person would come up, and, oh yes, we know this person. And they would, oh, wow. And they, imagine the excitement, and, you know, it's like the glow as you get closer and closer to this person. And so finally arrived where this person was living, kind of in the woods and foot of a mountain, quietly, by himself. And it was a glow of happiness. It didn't have to even ask. It was just like smiling, happy, eyes were glittering and good. And the person thought, maybe if this is finally it, I can finally ask for that shirt. The person didn't have a shirt. And that's kind of the lesson of the story. And you can kind of fill in for yourself what that might mean. But the person maybe had nothing. And is there something symbolic, at least, about not having anything that is a source of happiness? This is the example of a Buddhist monastic, is someone who's supposed to have very few things, very little, and whose happiness is not dependent on many of the material goods and many things that are normally expected in our lives. And I've met Buddhist monastics who have struck me as being very happy people, remarkably with very little things. One of the happy monks that I've known is Ajahn Amaro, an English monk, an abbot in England. He used to live here in the Bay Area for quite a number of years. And he was taken downtown San Francisco, and to give it, when he first arrived, a tour of San Francisco and tour of American business district and financial district. And the person who was giving him his tour said to him at some point, you're more wealthy than most Americans. Now, Ajahn Amaro had no wealth at all. He had no money. They're not allowed to have any money. He had his bowl and his robes, but, you know, he didn't really have any things, no bank account. And so Ajahn Amaro said, what do you mean I'm more wealthy than most Americans? And his guide said, you don't have any debt. So there's something about not having, whether it's literally not having, or it's a way of relating where we don't possess or don't hold on tight or don't depend on our material things, don't depend on physical appearance, don't depend on status or on work, don't depend on many of the things that people depend on in order to be happy. I just came back from a vacation in a country which is probably relatively poor compared to here. And what struck me was that everyone you met on the street, I don't know how happy they were, but they were all smiling. And they were all greeting you and happy to say hello and happy to be helpful. And I needed to get to the airport the last day. And we were running a little late, walking down the country road, pulling a suitcase. I think we'll get there in time to the airport. And there was a little gas station, and a woman pulled out with a little pickup truck, and right in front of us, you know, had gotten gas. And I said to her, you know, can we get a ride in the back of the pickup truck? She said, of course. And we climbed into the back of the pickup truck, and not only did she take us down to where we had to go, but she took us kind of out of the way and right up to where we had to go. And it seemed like everyone was helpful and everyone was generous and smiling, and it's quite a different experience than coming back. I was kind of like a little bit culture shock for a few moments when I came back to Los Angeles International Airport. That was quite a no one was going to say hello to me. So the idea of... So I offer this story as a challenge to you, for all of us, for myself as well, is how much do we need to be happy, and how much do we yoke our happiness to having things, whether it's physical things or whether it's experiences or relationships? How much do we, you know, are we requiring from the world in order for us to be happy? And is that necessary? Do we have some choice about it, what we do, how we are with it? One of the impressions I have about happiness here in our society, kind of more generally, is there's some current of thought among some people that happiness is something that we're supposed to be. It's a state of being. You can be a happy person. And so maybe we have a right to be happy. We're supposed to be happy. We're expected to be happy. And we're supposed to just be happy. Get over with it. Just be it. But happiness is not something that just is. And rather than being happy, it might be more realistic, at least from the point of view of Buddhist practice, to talk about doing happy. Not being happy, but doing happy. Because if we're just expecting to be happy, then it's kind of like magic thinking. It's kind of like we're supposed to just be granted it. It's just supposed to be, that's how it's supposed to be, and there's something wrong with me because I'm not happy, or, you know, I have a right to be happy, and or I have to kind of somehow do some kind of mental gymnastics in order to come into the state of being happy, as if it's a state of being. But what if happiness is, rather than being a state of being, is a state of doing? We do happiness. But certainly, if we do happiness as something we're trying to make ourselves happy, that doesn't work so well either. Because happiness is not the same as pleasure. Pleasure has a quality that almost anyone can make themselves feel pleasant sensations. It's a physical thing. You can, rub your arm, and that feels kind of pleasant, perhaps. Or you can have some food that's sweet, and that feels pleasant. Or, you know, you can pursue, and a lot of people pursue pleasant sensations and are addicted to it. But happiness is something deeper, and you can't actually, you know, make it. I think of it as a little bit like, at least for me, I can't make myself go to sleep. Maybe some of you can do that. I can make myself lay down in bed, and I've tried for years to make myself go to sleep. And it seems like every time I try to make myself go to sleep, I just mess it up, and I don't go to sleep. For me to go to sleep, I have to stop trying. And I just lay there, and then I drift off into sleep. So it's a kind of a thing that I have my responsibility, my role to play, but I have to also get out of the way. So this doing happy is not making happy. It's doing what's helpful to allow some deeper thing to have a chance to bubble up and to surface and to be there. And in Buddhist language, this is called conditionality. We create the conditions for happiness to arise. We can't be responsible to be happy in this always. We can't always do, we can't always make ourselves happy, but we can contribute the conditions that support us to be happy. And then if the other circumstances are just right, then happiness might bubble up. But the conditions might not be right for it. There might be other things that are more important. You might have all the conditions for happiness, but then you encounter someone who's suffering. And so what comes out is your compassion and not happiness. We create the conditions for it. But the creating the conditions is a doing. So that's why I like to think of we do happiness. Rather, we don't make happiness. We don't be happy. We do happy. So what are some of the do's? What are some of the activities, conditions that help support us to be happy? In Buddhist teachings, the first one that's emphasized over and over and over again is the importance of living ethically. So living in such a living in such a way, in the Buddhist understanding, what that means is living in a way that your life is not intentionally causing harm to anyone else. So you're not intentionally killing people or harming them, stealing from them, abusing them, lying them, engaged in sexual conduct which causes harm to people, that you don't cause harm. And when I, that first retreat that I did in Thailand, one of the surprises for me was to discover that I could feel happy or joyful from a sense of ethical purity, from a feeling, a sense that I was not involved in any harmful activities or motivations in my life. And that was something that I never had experienced before, that I first experienced through a deep meditation retreat. In fact, before that, people who felt were happy or thought encouraged people to be ethical, I kind of thought they were kind of like simplistic or too sweet or kind of goody-goody or something, that I didn't have a lot of respect for people who were, you know, too good. And it wasn't that I was unethical, I didn't have the imagination for that. But the, didn't fit in my universe exactly somehow. But in that first retreat that I sat, 10-week retreat, I discovered a kind of sense of well-being, a certain kind of delight or happiness or wholeness that I can only identify with being ethical, with a certain kind of ethical purity that was really inspiring me to feel from the inside. The other condition that this Buddhist tradition encourages, if you want to have put in place the things that support happiness, is generosity. To live a life that's generous. And even if you can't feel generous, it might be interesting to be generous anyway. Do generous things. Be supportive to people. Say hello. Ask people how they are. Open doors for people. Stretch yourself a little bit to make other people feel more comfortable and happy. Give little gifts. Do a variety of things that you feel like you're giving and supporting others. And it's not this teaching about generosity is not meant to be a moralistic teaching that thou shalt, but rather a pragmatic teaching that that kind of open-heartedness, the open-handedness of generosity, and the memories of how that produces good in the world, those can be conditions for happiness for ourselves. The third area of happiness, condition that supports happiness, that does, there's many things, but the third one that can be mentioned is meditation practice. And meditation practice is a condition for happiness in a variety of ways. And I'll mention two of them here. And those can be divided kind of neatly between, not inherently completely, but between more concentration practice and mindfulness practice. That there's something about the human physiology, neurology, hormones, whatever goes on, the chemistry of our system, that when we get fully absorbed in an activity, when we're no longer divided, when all the different fractured parts of our being come together and get really focused on something that's wholesome, something that's satisfying and good, that it tends to release a lot of pleasure and well-being and joy in the system. It's kind of, maybe for some people have the experience of reading a really nice novel and really getting pulled in. There's a feeling of goodness or in the concentration of it. Or some people do a craft or play a musical instrument or something. And there's something about getting absorbed into that and the world disappears around you. The problems of our day and what's coming up in the future disappear. And we're really fully here in the present for this activity, absorbed and present. And there's a kind of, it's called a unification process, an integration process, where we get unified in here in the present moment, focused on this here. And it just seems to be, it's a physiological event, that you don't have to want to be happy or joyful. It just kind of begins to well up from inside, like an inner fount or inner spring that comes up. And it's quite remarkable to have an experience of a sense of inner well-being and joy that's there for no external reason. We didn't win the lottery. We didn't have a fantastic meal. We didn't have, you know, time with our friends. We didn't, you know, all kinds of things. Normal things what people want in the world. We didn't get a shirt. It can feel like we just are being. And here's where we can come into this dimension of life where it begins feeling like I just am happy. Happiness is just a sense of being, though it's a being that arises from the doing that we've been doing. Without the doing, without the engagement, the concentration, the absorption, the unification of the practice, that sense of being happy is not going to well up. So this is one of the primary conditions for deep, very deep. And the kind of what's nice about this concentrated happiness is it's very deep. It's very integrated. It's like oozing or suffusing through our body, our being, in a very different way than happiness and joys that can happen that are evaluative, that come from, oh, that was really great. I'm so happy for that or something. It just kind of doesn't require any evaluation at all, no thoughts at all. It doesn't require rearranging our understanding of things because it happens outside of understanding. It happens just because of the absorption that we have in what we're doing. Some people, it's revolutionary to have this because they realize that they can be happy without getting a lot of things in the world to shift and arrange, be rearranged. Until they have this experience, some people are constantly trying to rearrange their life or to arrange things or get things or fix things. If I just get this job or this training or this promotion or this person to like me, then, and only then, if then I'll be happy. But to have all the if-thens, all the arrangements and doings fall away in the present moment absorption and feel this happiness well up that's free, costs nothing, you know, you don't have to pay anyone for it. It's kind of like a very different game in town. It's a very different perspective of what's going on. And it's very satisfying, and it offers people an alternative to always be searching for something outside, to getting something. We can find a wellspring of delight, joy, well-being, happiness in our own hearts, and we can carry it with us to some degree. The second kind of happiness that arises out of the condition of meditation is that from mindfulness, from vipassana, insight. And this works in many different ways, and I'll mention one here. And one is, at some point, we start seeing more and more clearly what in the world we're doing in this head of ours. You know, I don't know how it is for most of you. I don't know. I haven't been in your minds at all. But my mind is capable of a lot of nonsense. And, you know, it does all its thinking and thoughts and planning and remembering and concerning and repeating conversations and planning conversations. And it can get pretty crowded in there. And with this inner world of, you know, fantasy and ideas and imaginations that we have. And as we do this vipassana practice and start seeing what goes on, some people start seeing, well, this is a lot of nonsense. Or if you don't like the word nonsense, it doesn't apply to your mind because maybe you have a serious, mature mind that's different than mine. It's just crowded. Or it's swirling. Or it's just always busy. The mind doesn't know how to rest, doesn't know how to stop. Some people have no idea how busy their mind is, always swirling, always engaged, always until they start to meditate, because it's just otherwise it's just life, normal life. It's life as it's supposed to be lived. It's almost invisible. We're so involved in our thoughts that sometimes we don't even know we're thinking because we're so involved. So just to sit down and notice what goes on in this mind, maybe even independent of the content of the thoughts, but to see the speed of the thoughts or the strength of them or the attachment or the contraction or the forcefulness that's involved in this thinking is also kind of be a revolutionary thing for people to experience. It's a very important insight. Because then it's possible to put a question mark after or under or on top of that thinking mind. Is this really the way it has to be? Is it required for me to constantly be thinking this way? And then maybe the answer, first answer might be yes, because my family expects me to do this. My friends expect me to do this, or my society is forcing me to have these thoughts and take this into account. Is it really necessary? And that one of the great contributions of meditation is that it's one of the times in human life where it's supposed to be okay not to be involved in thinking. It's good to have a few like thinking free zones, and because it's such a good relief. It gives us such a different perspective on our life if we're not so caught up or wrapped up in our thoughts. So meditation is meant to be a thinking-free zone. Doesn't mean that we automatically stop thinking, but it means that we begin to disinvest ourselves in the value of thinking. We stop investing so much importance in our thoughts. And it's possible to see that, in fact, not only are you thinking, but you're giving a lot of importance to thoughts, a lot of emphasis on them. There's a searching and a wanting and a desiring that's fueling the thinking. It's part of the investment. But to stop the investment, partly because the return has been so poor, and then to begin to experience something else, a quiet mind, a stiller mind, or a larger, more spacious mind that might still be thinking, but the mind is not defined or delimited by the thinking. A thinking mind is very narrow and small. But a mind that is more meditative has a lot of space in it, a lot of openness, expansiveness. And then the thoughts can occur within that in a different kind of way. So in relationship to happiness, to begin seeing, understanding the nature of our thinking mind gives us at some point some choice about how to be involved in our thinking. And to say, wait a minute, maybe I don't have to think these thoughts. Maybe I don't have to always be thinking about the future. Maybe I don't have to keep repeating the past and all the hurts that I've experienced. Maybe I don't have to always be thinking these thoughts of desire, of wanting and wanting and wanting, or expectations. We start seeing more and more clearly what our expectations are and how we're latched onto them or limited by the expectation, frustrated by them, and how it maybe keeps us from having the openness where happiness can flow out. So at some point we start understanding more and more what our thinking is about, and as we do that, it's a very personal thing, personal exploration, because it's going to be different for every person how this works. But we hopefully start finding a way where we no longer are delimited by the thinking world, the way we think. Or we find a door in the mind where we can go through and step into a much bigger room that is not claustrophobic with this whole, cocktail party or whatever your, thoughts and ideas and things going on. When we can then shift our attention from our preoccupations into being more spacious and open, then it makes sense to ask, is it okay is it available right now to be more happy? Is there more happiness, more well-being, more joy available right now than I've been availing myself of? If I leave here, and I get mostly concerned about what's the traffic going to be on the freeway, and what's the best route to get home, and I want to avoid the traffic, and I'm late, and why did I stay so long, and I should get on to it. I can be consumed with these thoughts. I can see myself being consumed in those thoughts and say, why don't I just relax? Open that door of the mind. And notice it's a nice day. And maybe I can be like those friendly people that I saw the last 2 weeks. And maybe I could say hello to someone on the street and smile and notice someone. And I can feel happier. It's a pretty special. I'm living in one of the most opulent places in the whole, maybe the universe, for all we know. You know, it's pretty phenomenal. It was hard pulling that suitcase down the road because there wasn't much asphalt. We have asphalt. You ever thought about how wonderful that is? Especially if you're driving a car. You know, it's pretty cool. It's a lot of cool, wonderful things that support our lives and make it all go well. To look around and open up, is there some joy, some happiness, some contentment that's possible? I'm not trying to make a pretty picture of everything and not say there's not problems and difficulties. I don't want to do that. I want this kind of to help us actually be more available to look at the difficulties. But to be able to look at the difficulties, I don't know if being happy is the right word, but look at the difficulties without the unhappiness that we're preoccupied with and caught up in. To be able to understand the mind, understand ourselves, put together the conditions so that when we step out into the world, that we're not caught up, preoccupied, guilty, angry, frustrated, but we're able to avail ourselves of an open heart, an open mind, and be able to feel the sun and the smiles of other people and the goodness of this world. And in doing that, being able to meet other people with that goodness, have the joy spread. And if what we meet is the difficulties of our world, hopefully we meet it with more generosity and care and ethics than we would otherwise. We meet it with our goodness and try to make a change. So I hope this talk will encourage you to reflect a little bit about your relationship to happiness, the place of happiness in your life, or the absence of it. And is there something useful from this talk or from this consideration that might support you, nourish you, point you in a different direction? So that whatever your challenges are, whatever your unhappiness is and difficulties are, maybe there can be a sliver or a little whiff of well-being, of contentment, of encouragement, that there is a possibility of finding a happy life, with or without a shirt. Thank you all.